Welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. We are your hosts, Steffi and Janelle. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines for our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at beyond_headlines. One's identity frequently serves as a cornerstone for one's sense of belonging, often intertwined with their traditions and heritage. The case of Iberian Jews compelled to convert to Christianity underscores the remarkable duality and resilience required to uphold their traditions and beliefs. These covert observances, deemed as Judaizing, were punishable by severe penalties, including execution by inquisitional authorities in Spain and Portugal. The legacy of these crypto-Jews persists in their descendants to this day. We're joined by Rabbi Bejarano Gutierrez, who has written several books such as Secret Jews and Jews of Iberia. He joins us today for a timely discussion on crypto-Jews in Iberia, the Spanish Inquisition, and nation building.
Welcome, Rabbi. It's lovely to have you here today to learn from you, to understand something very, very historic, yet very timely in terms of identity and how we move forward. So I'd ask you to introduce yourself to our lovely audience listening today.
Well, thank you so much, Janelle and Steffi, for the invitation. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you. I have many hats that I wear, as I mentioned. I'm an engineer full-time. I have a degree in engineering. But my passion for many, many decades now, it's sort of hard to believe me to say that, has been in Jewish studies. Over a period of 15 years, I was able to study at the Siegel College of Judaic Studies in Cleveland, where I completed a master's degree in Jewish studies. And then from there, I continued part-time at the Spertus Institute for Jewish Learning and Leadership in Chicago, and I completed a doctorate in Jewish studies. And then while I was there, one of the rabbis and professors recommended a yeshiva program, a smicha program, rabbinic ordination to me. So I did that as well. And it took me about 15 years between all these different programs and my engineering work. And but that's sort of my educational background. And I continue to work as an engineer, but I'm also the rabbi of a small but growing synagogue in the Dallas area. And one of the key constituents or one of the key areas that we focus in on is helping individuals that come from Iberian Jewish backgrounds to return to Judaism, or at least to educate them if that's something that they're interested in. And so my wife and I are very much involved in guiding and growing the synagogue. And this topic that we're going to be discussing is extremely important to that cause and to that mission.
You've mentioned something that's sort of central to something Steffi and I have been talking about is a timeline, and really Spain and the central role they've played in the expulsion of Jews, you know, back in the, I believe it's the 14th, 1300s. So if you could start from there and talk about the decree that was passed down and really started this sort of travel from Spain to Portugal to then all these ports of the Portuguese Empire, and the Spanish Empire that was growing outside.
In order for us to understand the decrees of 1492, and then which eventually lead to expulsion decrees in Portugal and Navarra, we really have to go back just very briefly to talk about the Iberian Jewish community. By 1492, Jews had lived in the peninsula for more than 1,000 years. That's as far as we can verify archaeologically. If we look at the migration patterns of Jews in the Roman Empire, it's likely that they were there before. And legends and traditions argue that they go back to the time of the destruction of the First Temple under Nebuchadnezzar, King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonians. You know, that's interesting legends. I mean, they may be true. We don't have any proof for that. But the existence of a significant Jewish population in the Iberian Peninsula is without question verified, at least from the second century CE. And what's interesting is that by the medieval period, it represents the largest Jewish communities of Europe. It's a very large Jewish community. It's centered in Castile. There's a community in Aragon. There's a smaller community in the Kingdom of Granada that by the 15th century is the last Muslim stronghold on the peninsula. It's a vassal state, but it still has a measure of independence. And of course, Portugal, there's a small Jewish community there, and then there's a tiny one in Navarra. And what happens is there are ebbs and flows of Jewish existence. Under the Romans, there's generally sort of a positive relationship, one might say, until the occurrence of rebellions in the land of Judea, in the land of Israel, which sort of changed the dynamic. But after that, once we have the rise of Christianity and the Christianization of the Roman Empire, there's sort of a negative shift that happens towards Jews. Jews had some, you could argue they had sort of favored status in the Roman Empire. There were certain discretions that were available to them because of Julius Caesar or Augustus Caesar. They were favorably disposed, and there's reasons for that that you know we can talk about in the future. But by the time of the Visigoths, when the Western Roman Empire is falling, the Visigoths take over, and they, in the initial period, they have sort of a good relationship with Jews. But once they convert, once King Ricard the First converts to from Arianism to Catholicism or Chalcedonian Christianity, there's a shift that happens, and it begins a process in the 6th century of negative attitudes and edicts towards Jews. And so what we find in the 6th and the 7th centuries of the Common Era is we see discrimination, we see elimination of Jews being able to hold public office. And what's most important in 612 is we see a forced edict of expulsion. And the reason I mention that is because it sets the pattern for what we'll see in the 15th century. And what happens is apparently the majority of Jews dissimulated. They pretended to convert to Christianity. They stay, maybe some left, you know, to what we would call Gaul or France, maybe to North Africa, but the majority of them stay. And what we see over the next century before the Islamic conquest is we see a series of edicts that are passed by church councils in Toledo, as well as the various kings, the Visigothic kings. And they talk about something that's fascinating. It's dissimulation. Because when they talk about Jews during this 100-year period, they're all baptized, but they're practicing Passover, they're circumcising their children, they're doing things that they're not supposed to do according to classical Christian doctrine. And this is apparent to the monarchs and to the church. So we see these edicts being passed, like, you know, they have to renounce these things, but they always refer to them as Jews, which is interesting because it brings up this issue of identity. Because an individual who obviously converts would theoretically now be a Christian. But the fact that many of these individuals are Judaizing, as the Christian, as the church would refer to it as, it sort of begins to raise these questions of what does it mean to be Christian? What does it mean to be Jewish? At the beginning of the 8th century, we have the Islamic conquest. And for Jews, it's actually very positive because Muslims and Jews, you know, have sort of a unique relationship. You know, they both originate in the Middle East. They both have Semitic languages. You know, they both have, religiously speaking, they're sort of closer to each other, at least how classically they viewed each other, instead of Christianity, you know, in terms of strict monotheism. So the Muslims who invade, they sort of look to a natural partner, and they say, well, there's a lot of Christians, there's some Jews, let's pick the Jews to be sort of intermediaries. And so Jews begin to experience a new measure of freedom. That doesn't mean that under Islamic rule there weren't persecutions, and it's important to note that there were very severe persecutions in the 12th century, for example, but there were about 11 that happened. But what's significant about the 12th century under Islam is that there's also forced conversions, and there's also the practice of dissimulation. And I say that again because we're setting the pattern for what we're going to find later. And eventually, Islamic fortunes will fall. There's internal rifts. They can't sort of maintain uniformity. And the small Christian enclaves that were formed out of the Visigoths who fled north, and maybe the indigenous population that still hadn't accepted Islam, they begin a resurgence that takes hundreds of years, but eventually they'll begin a process of taking over the peninsula again, you know, moving south bit by bit. And as Islamic power wanes, Jews begin to move to these northern areas. So they now transfer from Islamic rule to the Christian kingdoms. And initially, the Christian kingdoms are very welcoming of Jews. They need people to come and settle in these areas because it's almost like no man's land. As Muslims withdraw, they're underpopulated. They want individuals who are craftsmen, who may be multilingual. They see the Jews as an asset, so they guarantee, you know, religious freedom or, you know, within certain parameters, and they can operate under different categories of work and so forth. But the challenge is that within historic Christianity, there's sort of this anti-Judaism I think scholars debate, is it anti-Semitism? I mean, to me, they're very closely related, and I think we'll see why. But there's always this undercurrent of an uneasy relationship between the Christian kingdoms and the religious orders and Jews, because there's this conflict. Jews and Christians, in essence, challenge each other's identity, I think, because they're close to each other in many ways, right? The origins of Christianity are in the land of Israel. The initial adherents of Christianity were Jews. Gets back to the question of identity. And so this issue is, it's almost like too close for comfort. And as Christian power, Christian kingdoms begin to rise in authority, their reliance on the critical roles of Jews begins to change. And so by the 14th century, in the middle decades of the 1350s, 1360s, there's a Castilian civil war. And what we see is a series of anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish propaganda that's utilized by one side against the other. And it's interesting because one of the complaints that's made is that there are too many Jews in the court. They're influencing too much, power on the king, King Pedro. He has a Jewish paramour, apparently. So there's a lot of accusations that are made by his illegitimate half-brother, Henry de Trastámara, and a lot of people feed into that sentiment, and there are attacks on the Jewish quarters. And every side sort of motivates these different sides. We have to solve the Jewish problem. The classical anti-Semitic perspectives of Jewish influence. And after that, Henry de Trastámara wins. This is, in the 1360s. And for the next few decades, there's a little bit of an unease. But the Cortes in Castile is beginning to adopt an anti-Jewish view, like there's too much Jewish influence, back to those issues. And in 1378, what happens, something very interesting. There's an archdeacon whose name is Ferran Martinez, and he hates Jews. I mean, he hates Judaism, he hates Jews. And over the next 13 years, he begins a process of attacking Jews in his vicinity, Vecija near Seville. And he wants synagogues destroyed. He wants Jews to be limited in their, professions and influence and so forth. And Jews are very aware of the threat, so they approach the king. They try to, basically appeal. And sometimes the king is sympathetic, to their plight, because from the standpoint of the Spanish monarchs, Jews are their property. So even if the church is insisting on something, the king and the queen have to make sure that their property is not damaged. Well, all this comes to the forefront in 1391 when we have a series of attacks or pogroms or violence that breaks out in Seville first. At the time, there are more than 80 Jewish communities that are scattered in Castile and Aragon. And slowly, over the summer of 1391, 80 of these communities are attacked. And what happens at the end of the summer of 1391, by August, we have basically a scenario that results in one third of the Jewish community may have been killed or may have died as an effect of the economic devastation, starvation. Another third of the Jewish community survives. They fled to the fields. They sort of, are hiding. And then up to a third of the Jewish community has been forced to convert or has converted out of, they're trying to preempt the violence. They know the violence is coming. They say, listen, if we convert, we'll legally be Christian. And maybe things will go back to the way they were in the future. This has happened before, the cases of the Visigoths and under the Almohades under Islam. So thousands and thousands of Iberian Jews convert. The violence doesn't affect Portugal or Granada or, it's really Castile and Aragon. And so in the beginning, the Christian reaction is like, oh, this is a miracle. We have potentially hundreds of thousands or 100,000, who knows exactly the number, of Jews who are now part of the Christian fold. This is almost like heralding the advent of the second coming of Jesus. It's a miracle. It's something that we wanted. But as time progresses, and this will lead us into why the decrees of expulsion take place, people begin to notice something, because the majority of Jews who converted did so to save their lives. I mean, that's pretty obvious. So they don't really have any motivation to study the catechism. They don't really have any motivation to go to mass, to partake of Christian rites. And for whatever reason, the church doesn't really have any motivation either to instruct them. It's sort of like laissez-faire, like they've converted, our job is done. Maybe they don't really have the resources, whatever it is. But many of these individuals live in the same neighborhoods that they did before. They have brothers and sisters and parents and children who didn't convert. So what happens? Well, when Passover comes along, Passover is coming up in a few weeks, they say, hey, we need to invite our cousin over for, for the Seder. But this person is legally Christian now, but they're inviting, over to a Jewish person's home. And this happens more and more. Some baptized Jews who are now conversos, in Hebrew we say anusim, they're forced converts. They're like just going about their life as they were before. They're buying kosher food, then maybe they go to synagogue on Shabbat. They're contributing money to the synagogues, for the sake of lighting the candles. They're going to their Jewish neighbors and Jewish family, and as time progresses, one of the things that happens is they're no longer legally bound by the restrictions that have been placed on Jews. So they can go into areas of finance and business and even the church that they were not legally allowed to before. But then as conversos begin to have success in these areas, the old Christians, because the conversos are called new Christians, the old Christians who are basically the descendants of the Visigoths and the Romano Gaulish, tribes and so forth. They're like, wait a minute, that guy was a Jew yesterday, so to speak. And today he's like the mayor, the alcalde mayor of the town. Like, how did that happen? And people begin to have resentment. Like, I know he has Jewish family, and I know he went to Passover. I know he has Jewish books. And these kinds of sentiments begin to grow. The conversos can't legally revert to Judaism, but nobody says that nobody's watching them necessarily what they do at home, and some of them are quite flagrant about their Jewish observance. And this becomes like an issue back to the question of identity. Who really is a Jew? Who really is a Christian? And in the minds of many Christians, these conversos can never truly be Christian. They're like a hybrid. And so what we see is we see this, there's a pamphlet that's written toward the latter part of the 15th century called El Alboraica. El Alboraica refers to the mythical animal that Muhammad rode on his ascent. It's like a hybrid animal. It's like a horse, but it has the tail of a different animal, and its back legs are part of another animal. It's just a hybrid. And so this El Alboraica says these conversos are like that. They're this hybrid. They have many faces. And what's dangerous from the perspective of the author and from much of the populace and as the church becomes aware of this, is that they see this as like a plot to subvert Christian doctrine, Christian practice, and the unity of the church. So they begin to say, well, this is a problem, and as long as there are Jews here, they will aid their converso brothers and sisters and cousins. And by this time, we're talking about several generations after the fact. They're going to be helping them and educating them, and they're going to continue with these heretical views because, from the standpoint of the church, they're Christian, but they're engaging in a heresy. So these issues eventually come to the fray in the form of violence in 1449 and 1467, 1471. There are actually riots and battles that take place in different cities like Toledo and Ciudad Real, Cordoba. We're talking about like siege engines and, militia. It's an amazing portrait, but there are conversos fighting old Christians because conversos are feeling, they're coming after us. We have to defend ourselves. We'll never be good enough to identify the way that they want. And from the standpoint of the old Christians, the identity of these conversos is not in question. They're Jews. And so, battles break out. And so one of the solutions that comes up that's offered is a reinvigorated Inquisition. The Inquisition was not new. The original form went back to the papal inquisitions against the Albigensian heresy, the Cathars in southern France in the 13th century. But once that issue was sort of dealt with, there might have been bishop-led inquisitions, witchcraft, or maybe Jews helping forced converts return, but it was very localized. But now it's like a national crisis in Castile in particular. And this individual by the name of Alonso de Spina says, we need like a reinvigorated national inquisition that will surpass, whatever came before, because from his standpoint, this is a cancer. And the cancer is spreading. There are conversos in all the major cities, they're in positions of authority, influence. And as the number of Jews in the royal court decline, guess who takes their place? It's conversos. So you still have Jews in the royal court as courtiers, as financiers, as advisors, and now you have conversos. And then the old Christians are like, now we have more. You know, we have Jews and we have conversos, but they're all the same, you know, from their standpoint. So for them, it's like a threat to the integrity of Christian identity. And as Ferdinand and Isabella come onto the scene, you know, what they want is stability, right? They want to consolidate their power. They need to placate the nobles and the populace that have these anti-Jewish sentiments, but at the same time, they want to protect the Jewish communities that are under their protection because, again, they're their property. So the benefits, the taxes, the loans, forced loans that they impose on the Jewish communities, that benefits the king and queen. So it's like a balance that they have to maintain. We want to address the converso identity crisis. But we have to protect the Jewish community, but the Jewish community is feeding, you know, the converso question. So all of this happens in the 1470s, and then in 1478, the situation becomes so serious that they appeal to Pope Sixtus IV, and they say, "Can we have essentially a reinvigorated, you know, Inquisition that will basically have police powers that hadn't been present before?" And he says, "Yes, you know, I recognize the situation." It's introduced into Castile and Aragon, and it operates. It starts in 1478. It doesn't have its first auto de fe, its first public, you know, executions and decrees of guilt, punishment, until 1481. But then it slowly begins to spread throughout Castile and Aragon, and you know, many conversos are affected. In the beginning of this process, we hear stories where you know, like 15,000 conversos like fled. You know, different areas because they know what's coming. And, you know, the Inquisition is complex. We have a lot of revisionist scholars that try to minimize the Inquisition, saying, well, you know, torture breeds about false testimony. But I don't think it's so false. I mean, I'm not obviously advocating torture, but this is a class of individuals. It's like a fourth class of Iberian society, and it's sort of self-reproducing. And the distinctions between culture, religion, and we want to say ethnic identity, religious identity, they're all mixed together. So you might have a converso that participates in Christian rites, but they also have this other side to them that, you know, they might practice, you know, Jewish prayers. They do both. And this is the way they grow up. In fact, we have one case, I'll just tell you quickly, very famous Juan, or not famous to most people, but Juan de Hoyo. He's interviewed by the Inquisition and they ask him, are you a Christian? And he says, I'm not sure. And they say, do you believe in Jesus? He goes, yes, but he's not the Messiah. The Messiah's to come. And he starts giving these very convoluted answers. And you can tell it's bred out of ignorance, but it's also this unique identity which mixes some Jewish elements and some Christian elements, because by that time, many conversos they don't have the education, right, that they're fathers, grandparents, and so forth had. So it's like a mix. And so when they go before the tribunal, they're probably saying, you know, this kind of mixture. And from the standpoint of the Inquisition, this is heretical. Now, sometimes the Inquisition will take like a lighter approach. They'll focus in on education, but sometimes they'll say this person is a threat. And especially if they have relapsed more than, you know, they've relapsed after being reconciled to the church, then it's capital punishment. That's why they're burned at the stake. And then at that point, they're given the choice. Do you want to be reconciled to the church? And what we'll do is we'll strangle you. We'll use the garrote. You're still going to get burned, but at least you'll be dead, right? Before you are burned alive. Some people say, no, I'll die openly as a Jew. And other people say, no, I prefer to not suffer that kind of horrible pain. And so this happens from 1481, and it continues on from that point on. But by 1492, the issue of Judaizing has not been resolved. So the Inquisition was supposed to solve that problem, but from the standpoint of King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, it hasn't resolved it. We see the trials, we see the process, but something's not right. And so what's made, the argument that's made is that the reason that this is ongoing, and if you looked at the Edict of Expulsion, it specifically mentions Judaizing as the reason for the expulsion. And what they say in the edict is that the presence of Jews is practicing Jews is ultimately the issue. Why? Because when Passover comes, openly practicing Jews will tell conversos, oh, by the way, You need to get all of your chametz, all of your leaven out of your house because it's Passover next week. Oh, by the way, here's that book that you asked me about that has the Hebrew prayers that you wanted to, you know, it's this back and forth relationship. And from the monarchs, they're like, as long as we have the source of information, the conversos will continually practice Judaism on some level. So in 1492, after having conquered the last bastion of Islamic rule on the peninsula, the Kingdom of Granada, the monarchs feel more empowered to resolve the Jewish question. They don't necessarily need the benefits, shall we say, of the Jewish community. And so they issue an edict of expulsion, I think with the hope that the majority of the Jewish community would convert instead of leave. And so about 50,000 do convert. And I think it's important to note that many people left. Some of them go to Portugal, where they'll be eventually forced to convert again with no choice. But some people go to North Africa and some people go to Sicily or Naples. But what happens there is that sometimes they're not allowed to stay because they're not allowed to deboard, or there may be plague, or you know, different circumstances. So they don't have anywhere to go. And where do they go? They go back to the Iberian Peninsula. But if you're caught not having been baptized, it's capital punishment. So we have many people that leave, but then they don't have anything. They go back to the Iberian Peninsula and they convert. So about 50,000 convert, and you know, scholars debate the numbers, but maybe 100, maybe 150,000 don't. So some of them go to North Africa, but most go to Portugal initially. And in Portugal, Jews have largely been protected from violence, but there's a problem. And that's the king of Portugal wants to marry the daughter of King Ferdinand and Isabella. You know, that's always good for, you know, regal relationships, but there's a condition to the marriage, and that from the standpoint of the Castilians and Aragonese, that there will be no Jews in the Kingdom of Portugal. And so the king of Portugal agrees to this, but he doesn't want Jews to leave. So what he does, in essence, is he creates this scenario, I won't get into all the details, where he basically forces all of them to convert. He takes away children, and then, you know, a parent faced with, you know, their children being separated is, what are they going to do? Some parents actually will kill their children. It's an amazing reflection of the type of religious perspective that they have, because from their standpoint, you know, to be baptized is idolatry. Other people say, well, it's forced. It's, you know, we don't have the same religious halachic issues, but the majority of the population is forced to convert. And now you have this new Christian population within Portugal. Now, in that sense, Portugal is much more, let's say, tolerant. I'm not sure that that's the word, but they realize that these individuals haven't converted out of desire. So they say, you're not going to be prosecuted for crimes for 20 years. And then after that, you know, it'll be like a less, it won't be as a strict form as what we see in the Spanish holdings. Eventually, much later in the 16th century, the Portuguese version of the Inquisition will be established. And then over time, it will begin to have the same kind of ferocity that ferociousness that the Spanish equivalent does. And so that's sort of a breakdown of why the Inquisition comes on the table. It's because of Judaizing and because of conversos. And I'll stop there to let you, if not, I'll keep going. So.
No, I think you can keep going. The theme that's emerging here, and I don't think Stephanie and I consider this, is the duality of identity while these events are taking place, is that the conversos and the Jews kind of still having a relationship, and that's causing the major part of tension. I don't think that came through our research, but certainly it wasn't top of mind when you're wondering why the Inquisition needed to happen. And so I think that's fantastic what you pointed out, but I'll let you continue about Portugal and its
Yes.
and then we'll
And
come back to it.
this is Beyond the Headlines. You've been listening to a conversation about crypto Jews in Iberia, and we're joined by guest Rabbi Bejaran Gutierrez. Thank you for tuning in, and remember to add your voice to the conversation by sending us a comment on Twitter at beyond underscore headlines. For those who just tuned in, you're listening to Beyond the Headlines. We are a weekly public affairs talk show that airs every Monday at 11 a.m. on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, online through our website, and across podcast platforms such as Apple Podcast and Spotify. This week, we are discussing crypto Jews in Iberia, the Spanish Inquisition, and nation building. Have you enjoyed the conversation so far? Want to add your voice? Send us a tweet at beyond_headlines. If you have suggestions or feedback for our show, consider leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. We're listening.
Yeah, and let me say something. There's in the early part of the 1400s, as conversos are sort of exploring these new opportunities that are given to them, it's interesting to see how Christian society reacts to them. There are many Spanish, there are many converso poets, there's a very famous, the Count of Paredes is a poet who writes about, his name is El Ropero, he sells clothes. Juan El Ropero, I think is his name. I can't think, I forgot the specific name, but he's a converso poet. And he says something like, he's always going to be a Jew. You know, it doesn't matter what he does. He's sort of trapped within this identity. And there's a saying that says, his name is Shmuel, his name is Reduan, and his name is Juan. And he says, why does he have these three names? Because Juan is a name so that he will, you know, exceed, he'll have success in business, you know, his Christian identity. Reduan is an Arabic name, so he won't be killed. But a Jew, Juan, that's the one that I know for sure that he is. And it's this kind of idea that Christians have is like, you can't ever lose your Jewish identity. Mm-hmm. And it's this kind of, it's the beginning. One thing that I failed to mention is the limpieza de sangre, the purity of blood laws. These ideas of the inability for a converso to truly lose their vestiges of Jewishness, they transform the idea of identity. In the 13th century, there was something called the Siete Partidas. It's basically a regal code that's established under Alfonso the Wise. And it states who is a Jew, who's a Christian, who's a Muslim. And this legal code, you know, states it very simply. A Jew is a person who follows the law of Moses, who believes in Moses, who is circumcised. It's a religious definition. Mm-hmm. But in the 1400s and in the 1500s, it transforms into this sort of racial, ethnic, blood identity. And I think you can see very clearly the Nazis don't come up with this. They're drawing from this idea that a person can never lose their Jewish blood. And so what happens in the latter part of the, in the middle decades, as well as the latter part of the 15th century, is these purity of blood laws that say, if you have a Jewish grandparent, or, you know, there's different degrees, you're not allowed to study at this university. You cannot join this order of knights. You cannot join this guild. You cannot do this. And so in essence, it relegates conversos to this underclass that's sort of intended to minimize their influence and sort of identify them as a stained people. And so what people will do over the next several centuries is they'll hire people to make sure that they don't have any questionable blood or questionable ancestry in their family. Because, of course, many families will intermarry with conversos out of financial need, but others don't want to be tainted by that. They don't want that stigma. And, of course, you can pay people, you can bribe people to sort of erase things. But it's this idea of a transformation in identity to racial identity, which I think is critical, and we see that in the Iberian Peninsula. Now, in the midst of all of this, 1492, expulsion decrees from Portugal, of course, we have these momentous changes that are happening in exploration. The Portuguese have been exploring Africa, you know, in the 1400s. They've established trading posts as they make their way with the goal of reaching east, of course, India. And the Spanish have been looking to the west, and of course, 1492 with the quote-unquote discovery of America. This sort of provides conversos with new possibilities. Some conversos are able to escape. They'll make their way to Italy. They'll make their way to North Africa. Some will eventually join their relatives in the Ottoman Empire, which is very welcoming of Jews. And that's why we have in places like present-day Turkey or Greece, there were historic Spanish and Portuguese communities that left the Iberian Peninsula after the expulsions or sometime thereafter. And that's why today we still have what we call Judaismo or Judeo-Espanol or Ladino, These communities that existed for hundreds of years, retaining elements of their Iberian history and culture, and they sort of recreate that in the Ottoman Empire. So conversos have different options. They can try to navigate, travel, and go to where they can practice openly, or they look to the West, these undiscovered lands, these new territories, because I think by this time, we're talking 100 years after the initial conversions. And then, of course, in 1496, 1497, you have the Portuguese forced conversions. So there's like a reinforcement of another generation of conversos or new Christians. I think many conversos begin to question, like, will I ever be free? Like, if I go to the East, maybe the Muslims will impose something similar. So some of them look to the West. And we know, for example, that with Columbus, there were at least five conversos. And what happens is, as Spanish conquistadors begin to explore the Caribbean, and eventually the mainland, what will become Nueva España, there are conversos with them. They're not supposed to be there because the crown has issued decrees limiting their immigration. You're not supposed to have somebody whose ancestor was prosecuted by the Inquisition. You're not supposed to have somebody who is newly converted, but they get there anyways. It's not an easy process for people to verify. People change their names, their places of origin. And so eventually they'll find themselves throughout the New World, and you find these Jewish communities established in places like Mexico City after the conquest. They'll be in Lima, they'll be in Peru and Colombia throughout the holdings of the New World under the Spanish. They'll also be in Brazil. They'll be in anywhere the Portuguese are located. And the Portuguese set up Goa, as you mentioned, as sort of the critical center for their overseas dominions, as the place where the Inquisition will, that'll be sort of the central processing area. And the Spanish will set up multiple tribunals in the New World, and of course they'll continue within Spain, and Portugal, of course, will continue as well. And over time, the number of Judaizing cases will begin to diminish because they've been prosecuted so heavily. People are beginning to change the way that they express themselves religiously. What we see is that many conversos begin to join other movements that at first seem odd. For example, there's an Alumbrado movement in Spain, the Illuminist movement. It's almost like an early Protestant type movement. They don't have Catholic imagery. They don't have ritual prayer in the same way that Catholics do. They don't have rosaries. If you think about it, it's a much more acceptable type of religious expression to somebody who doesn't want to participate in what they would have considered to be, we would say, Avodah Zarah, idolatry. So it's more of a meditation, prayer. There's nothing offensive. And many conversos join these types of movements. And what also happens in the early part of the 1500s is that Protestantism, in its early form, becomes much more of a serious threat. Remember, in Spain or Castile and Aragon, the Inquisition has been operating for, basically 30, 40 years. So they've been pushing Judaizing extremely, that's been their focus. Now they begin to sort of shift and say, well, we need to deal with Protestants. We need to deal with censorship of books that may promulgate these, Protestant heresies. They begin to deal with things like witchcraft and bigamy, blasphemy, things of this nature. And it's almost like converso identity also begins to change because they're also being influenced by these other religious movements at the same time. But there are resurgence, there are periods of resurgence of Judaizing. As in 1580, for example, when we have the union of Castile and Aragon and Spain with Portugal, Spain will control Portugal until 1640. And as a consequence, many new Christians or conversos in Portugal will go to Castile for economic opportunity. But what happens? They're no longer subject to the Portuguese Inquisition, which was very active at the time, but now they're subject to the Spanish Inquisition. So that you see these periods of resurgence, and what's interesting is you also see them in the New World, where you might see, frantic activity. You might have 100 arrests, where you haven't had any for a year or two or several, and then there'll be dramatic autos da fé. There'll be burnings at the stake. And you see these kinds of waves, it begins to lessen, but I don't think it's because conversos disappeared. I think they just modified their identity. And what they begin to have is really a memory of something in the past, but they don't necessarily understand the rationale for the memory. And I think this is why when we have modern cases of individuals who talk about, traditions and their family, they don't really understand the reason or the rationale for them. But when you look at inquisitional trials, you see the same type of practices, the same type of customs that don't really have any kind of logic to them. Many times, what's interesting is that they no longer have a distinctly Jewish source, because what's happened is that people have transformed the original to something else. We have a case, for example, that I think you'll find interesting. Of course, a Brit Milah circumcision of the male member is sort of the essence of the covenant in traditional Judaism. Well, if you're circumcised, there's no way that you can talk yourself out of that if you get caught by the Inquisition. So we see a case, for example, in Mexico, where instead of circumcising the male member, they'll cut out like a piece of their shoulder. And it's like, who would think of that? But it's almost like, we can't do this, so we'll do this. But you can imagine over time how that wouldn't make any sense to somebody who's looking back at that until you realize that it's this modification of practice. I did want to note that over time, with the emergence of the Dutch Republic in the Netherlands, because the Spanish controlled the Netherlands in the 1500s into the 1600s, and there's a war that precedes, many conversos will flee to the Dutch Republic because it's a Protestant entity. And the product, the Dutch are fighting the Spanish, who are Catholic, the Dutch are Protestant. And so the conversos are, well, we're Portuguese. And from the Dutch perspective, okay, you're not Spanish, you're Portuguese. You're welcome. And as Jews, they're sort of like, well, they don't necessarily believe what we believe, but we both have the same common enemy, which are the Spanish. And so what you find in Amsterdam and eventually in Hamburg and eventually over a century, eventually in London, all these different places, you have conversos that have left the peninsula and they've recreated Jewish communities from the ground up. Now they have rabbis that have come from Italy or North Africa, et cetera. But the composition of these synagogues, some of which exist to this day, were conversos. They were individuals who had been separated from Judaism at the minimum for 100 years, in some cases much more than that. And they are essentially entering into a Jewish environment, but they're doing so as Christians, really, if you think about it, right? They're really having to relearn. They have some elements of Jewishness, but they're really having to enter into a new environment. And the reason I mention this is because when you read about these conversos or former conversos who left, you read their writings, you can see the duality of identity. They approach Judaism from the standpoint of their Catholic training. Many of these individuals are university trained, they're very well educated. And so sometimes they struggle. Sometimes they struggle because they've been exposed to different ways of thinking. And their image of Judaism often is very different from what they encounter in Amsterdam, for example. Because if you look at the situation throughout the Spanish and Portuguese holdings, really the only access to a Jewish text would be what? It would be the Bible. The Christian Bible includes the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible. It includes the Apocrypha, which are Jewish books. I mean, they're from the Second Temple period. They're not found in the canon of the Jewish Bible, but they're still Jewish books. So for many conversos, the only access that they have to learning about Judaism is reading the Bible. But of course, it's a different type of Judaism, right? It's something that's more ancient. So their imagery of Judaism is often different. And so when they go to Amsterdam and they encounter modern rabbinic Judaism, it's very like odd to them. Like, I didn't expect this, and so sometimes they struggle, and it's this whole question of identity. And many people will maneuver this successfully, and some of them won't. Some of them will actually return to the peninsula because it's almost better the devil you know type of scenario where they feel more secure. And yet some of them, when they get to a place where they can practice Judaism, some of them will say, you know what? I prefer not to do anything. I prefer not to be tied to any religious expression. Or some of them may become Protestant. It's sort of an interesting mix, but you have these communities of conversos that will eventually lead to the creation of Jewish communities in the Caribbean that are founded by these former conversos or their descendants. And then eventually in Brazil and eventually in the United States, or the 13 colonies, where the first synagogues in the 13 colonies are founded by who? By the descendants of Spanish and Portuguese Jews. And so it's an amazing story that you find in different parts of the world that are all tied to this question of identity, the Inquisition, and then ultimately me back to the presence of Jews in the Iberian Peninsula. So I'll stop there again as a breather, just to let
Yeah.
you comment.
This is Beyond the Headlines. You've been listening to a conversation about crypto Jews in Iberia, and we're joined by guest Rabbi Bejarano Gutierrez. Thank you for tuning in, and remember to add your voice to the conversation by sending us a comment on Twitter at beyond_headlines.
Thank you for that. That I think you've hit on the central point of returning back, and I don't know if you have any questions, Steph.
Yes, I could just add a bit here. I think for me, the overarching theme here is identity and how it's very apparent throughout this history. And identity is such a central theme to human hope and the human spirit. And it's also apparent in the history that the story you tell is often determined by where you start the clock. And this can tie into the complex journey of return to identity that a lot of people face. And so my question is, how does one return back to identity?
Well, in the scope of the Jewish community, I would address that first. It's a complex question because, unfortunately, for much of the 20th century, let's put it that way, most Jews were unfamiliar with this history. The Converso dilemma, the Converso phenomena, was something that was sort of relegated to ancient times, you know, one might say pre-modern times. The fact that there are individuals today that say, listen, I can prove that I'm a descendant, or I have oral traditions, or we have certain practices, was something that most Jewish communities were, I would say, unprepared for. I mean, the benefit that we have in the 21st century is that we have so much information, the internet, there's so many organizations now that are, you know, preserving this information for others. It gives people choices, but then it's a question about, do I want to religiously reintegrate, or do I just want to be able to say, I'm proud of my ancestry. I want to honor that, but I don't want to integrate into the Jewish community. You have many choices that are before the people that sort of discover this. And in my particular case, I try to support whatever choice they make. If they want to reintegrate into the Jewish community, there are practical things we have to, you know, are they circumcised? You know, if they're not, obviously, then they need to be circumcised. They need to go through what we would call Hatafatam Brit. We don't need to go into all the details. They would need to go through education. They're going to get married, you know, in the Jewish rites and so forth. Some people don't want to do that. They just want to honor their identity. So what they do is they study. That's the form that they sort of recapture it. They honor it. They attend Jewish lectures. They sort of teach that to their children. Some of them, you know, choose to fight anti-Semitism and participate in organizations that they feel, you know, maybe aren't religiously focused, but are supporting of individuals that recognize, you know, their identity. Other people will take advantage of laws that were passed in Portugal and Spain, you know, the sort of this right of return for individuals that were descendants of people that were expelled. And they'll look at Spanish citizenship or Portuguese citizenship as sort of righting the wrong, so to speak. And for them, that's sort of the end of the journey. They're content to do that. So I think it really depends on the individual. And in that sense, it mirrors the choices that conversos had. Some chose to return, some chose to stay, and some chose to sort of reject both worlds and become these non-religious entities.
I certainly like what you've mentioned here. It's no longer just duality of identity as in ethnicity or culture, but it also comes down to religion. As conversos, like if you have been forced into Christianity in communities that were so heavily penalized, like if you look at Goa with the Inquisition that started there, was went through and then had burnt all the records and all evidence that it happened. Christianity is my only defense mechanism. And it breeds this militant, and what I found, militant Catholicism, where there's almost a dependence on survival with that particular religion. And I found that. And any deviation from that has a very traumatic response. Something in you is being triggered. You can't do that, right? And any deviation from that within those sort of little communities, I believe, is tied right back to the past. And this comes in with the duality of, but you still maintain culture. The culture has still managed to survive. Someone said somewhere, keep quiet about who you really are, adopt Catholicism to survive the Inquisition, but we're not going, But I don't know how to live as a Catholic. I don't know how to live traditionally like that because all I've been taught is one way. And so you end up with a culture at home, food, traditions, wedding celebrations that mirror something you don't really understand, but you're militantly Catholic. And that has become Catholic. I find the idea of the remnants of Jewishness has now, at least in these communities, Catholicized.
Yeah, one of the questions that I ask when I get contacted by people that are interested in returning formally, religiously, is I ask them about their family. What does their family think about that? If they're married, of course, we're interested in the spouse. Because sometimes the reactions are very, standoffish. I think that's begun to change because we live sort of in this pluralistic environment today. And I think in the case of the United States, and I think probably Canada as well, it's sort of a religious marketplace. It's not uncommon for people to switch, multiple denominations if they're Christian. It's a much easier transition, but I think in other parts of the world, it's a much more sharp, drastic change. But even I think in Latin America, it's a very that kind of mentality that you talk about. I think it's much more prevalent because they're much more homogeneous societies. There are Jewish communities that are present in Mexico, but sometimes anti-Semitism is often much more openly discussed. The stereotypical views of Jews, and sometimes the demographic makeups of the Jewish community in certain Latin American countries, they sort of fulfill the stereotypes. I guess that makes sense. In America, we have about 5 or 6 million Jews, depending on how you count. And you can find school teachers, you can find welders, you can find engineers, you can find bank. I mean, every spectrum, right? From every economic, social standpoint, from poverty to wealth. But sometimes in Latin America, you have sort of these very smaller communities, but they're very successful. And in contrast to the majority populations, they sort of hold a higher strata, social economic. So it sort of reinforces this imagery of Jewish power and Jewish money. And like, for example, in Mexico, as you probably well know, the likely president of Mexico is someone who's from a Jewish background. And if I understand correctly, she's actually from a Turkish background. She has an Ashkenazic last name, Sheinbaum, but it's actually from a Spanish and Portuguese origin. So how odd, isn't it, that all these centuries after you have the first female likely be president. But in some sense, it's also problematic, I think, because it sort of fulfills this kind of notion of they have power. And for a society that is already sort of uncomfortable because of religious perspectives that go back, for a millennia, it's not necessarily positive. And I've seen this in, firsthand. So I think those of us in the United States or Canada, we have maybe a different vantage point. I think it's if you look at other countries, the perceptions that we sort of characterize as medieval or pre-modern, they're still very prevalent. And so this idea of somebody returning is often very, it's emotional, not just in their own desire to return, but it's about the impact on their family and even potential, you might say, danger. What kind of how will their relatives and neighbors react to this black sheep, if you will? So I think that sometimes we lose that sense of, the Inquisition ended, a long time ago, but the attitude has not necessarily. And I think that people don't necessarily understand the psychological and the emotional turmoil that people undergo.
Right. I think that's so well put because this notion of inherited trauma, we hear that perpetuated with the Holocaust. But I was talking to Stephanie before this, and I think this period of history was lost, and the idea of that inherited trauma in itself was lost because people don't remember it through a Jewish context. They see it as a very colonial taking over land, but not specific groups of people, specifically the Jews. And so I think when you talk about inherited trauma, it's very in sort of very recent terms. And I think as we start to reconcile with that particular period, there's a resurgence of that Inquisition mentality that I don't think we have contended with entirely. Fantastic response to that. This whole hour has been educational, to say the least. It has been eye-opening, and I hope that our audience listening has been able to learn as much as Stephanie and I have. Unfortunately, we've run out of time,
I understand.
but you've managed to answer everything, all the questions we had, and really paint a comprehensive picture of what it looked like to live in Spain or Portugal, pre-Inquisition, as it was going on, and the long-lasting effects of it. So I want to thank you so very much for taking time out of your very busy week, and coming to speak with us. And if you have any last words for anybody who's listening, now's your time. Come up with me.
Well, thank you so much to both of you, Janelle and Steffi, for the opportunity. It's my privilege to talk about this. I think the one thing that I take away whenever I have conversations like this is that we live in a contentious world, politically, religiously. Engagement, conversation, I think, is the ultimate path forward. And I think that's really the thing that we can embrace, whatever our particular views are. These discussions have an impact on people. And so I applaud your work in investigating this because I think people don't realize the past. And the way forward is to study and to engage. And if anyone has questions regarding Converso identity, please have them reach out to me. My goal is education. It's not conversion or return. It's whatever is appropriate to that person, but it's really to support them in this process. So many thanks to the both of you again for this opportunity.
You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by Rabbi Bejarano Gutierrez. Thank you so much for coming on to the show to discuss crypto Jews in Iberia, the Spanish Inquisition, and nation building. CIUT is a nonprofit community radio station and relies heavily on donations for its operating budget. Beginning this week, CIUT is hosting its spring fundraising drive. Any donation you can give would be greatly appreciated and will go directly towards supporting high-quality community radio. Donate today at www.ciut.fm. Thank you. Today's show was produced by Janelle and Steffi. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you are listening. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out our podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada, follow us on Twitter at beyond_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook or Instagram. Thank you once again for listening.